Well, it was nearly 50 years ago, Sunday, March 7th, 1965. Millions of Americans were watching the ABC Sunday night movie. Remember when there was no cable TV and there was no Netflix and we watched movies on commercial television? The movie was Judgment at Nuremberg, starring Spencer Tracy as the American war crimes judge. The kind of movie that would attract liberals to watch it on a Sunday night. Burt Lancaster was the accused Nazi magistrate. Shortly after 9 p.m., ABC interrupted the movie for a special news bulletin. One person who watched the bulletin later wrote this account. The pictures of the news reporters that the news reporters showed were not particularly good, with the cameras far removed from the action and the skies partly overcast. Everything that happened took on a quality of an old newsreel. Yet this quality, vague and half-silhouetted, gave the scene the vehemence and immediacy of a dream. The TV screen showed a column of Negroes striding along a highway. A force of Alabama troopers blocked their way. As the Negroes drew to a halt, a voice spoke an order from a loudspeaker. In the interests of public safety, they were telling the marchers to turn back. A few moments passed, measured out in silence, as some troopers covered their faces with gas masks. On the left side of the screen, there was a lurching movement. A heavy line of troopers charged straight into the column, bowling the marchers over. A shrill cry of terror rose up as the troopers lumbered forward, stumbling, sometimes on the fallen bodies. The scene cut to charging horses, their hoofs flashing over the fallen. Another quick cut, a cloud of tear gas billowing over the highway. Periodically, the top of a helmet head emerged from the cloud, followed by a club on the upswing. The club and the head would disappear into the cloud of gas, and another club would bob up and down. So all across the United States, people who had been watching a movie about the Nazis were suddenly seeing the attack in Selma, watching it on Sunday evening. The next morning, Monday, March 8th, every major newspaper carried the story in large headlines, with photos of state troopers standing over an injured marcher. Millions across the nation read the newspaper accounts of what had happened. State troopers and mounted deputies bombarded 600 praying Negroes with tear gas today and then waded into them with clubs, whips, ropes, injuring scores. The troopers and posse men under Governor George C. Wallace's orders to stop the Negroes walked for freedom from Selma to Montgomery, chased the screaming, bleeding marchers nearly a mile back to their church, clubbing them as they ran. Ambulances screamed in relays between Good Samaritan Hospital and Brown's Chapel Church, carrying hysterical men, women, and children, suffering head wounds and tear gas burns. In Atlanta, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. announced that he would lead a new march from Selma on Tuesday, and called on clergymen from throughout the nation to join him. Well, 50 years ago, in many southern cities, white people did not allow black people to vote. In Selma, Martin Luther King Jr. had decided to organize a voter registration drive among blacks, building on the work that the Student Nonviolent Coordination Committee that had been there for 2 years. Day after day, African Americans had gone to the courthouse in Selma to register. Day after day, police had arrested them in the hundreds. The march to the state capitol in Montgomery, 50 miles away, was an attempt to draw attention to this injustice. The voter registration drive had already killed one person. In Marion, a town 50 miles north of Selma, a 26-year-old man named Jimmy Lee Jackson had walked in a voter rights march with his mother and his grandmother. State troopers attacked the march. Jackson, his mother, and his grandmother ran into a cafe in Marion to avoid the troopers. The troopers came into the cafe, smashed the lights within reach, and began clubbing the people indiscriminately. When a trooper hit Jimmy Lee's mother and knocked her screaming to the floor, Jimmy Lee lunged at him. The trooper struck him across the face, then picked him up and slammed him against a cigarette machine. Another trooper drew a pistol and shot Jackson in the stomach. Jimmy Lee Jackson died in a hospital a few days later. That Sunday night, March 7th, 1965, in Boston, a Unitarian Universalist minister and his wife were putting their four young children in bed, and afterward, they stayed up until 11 p.m. to watch the news. They saw pictures of the beatings. And the next day, Reverend James Reeb received a call in his office from the Unitarian Universalist Association headquarters in Boston. Homer Jack, the director of social responsibility, had received a telegram for Dr. King. Homer Jack was a founder of the Congress of Racial Equality in 1942 and a founder of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy in the late 1950s, and then became the director of social responsibility. He was also a friend of mine. Homer read parts of the telegram that he'd received from Dr. King to Reverend Reed over the phone. In the vicious maltreatment of defenseless citizens of Selma, where old women and young children were gassed and clubbed at random, we have witnessed an eruption of the disease of racism which seeks to destroy all America. No American is without responsibility. The people of Selma will struggle on for the soul of the nation, but it is fitting that all Americans help bear the burden. I call, therefore, on clergy of all faiths to join me in Selma for a minister's march to Montgomery on Tuesday morning, March 9th. Now, years later, I talked to Homer about this conversation he had with Jim Reed, and he said to me, "Jim, ask Homer, Homer, do you think I should go?" And Homer replied, "Well, Jim, it's up to you. I'm going to go." Reed checked with his supervisor at the American Friends Service Committee, where he worked, and received permission to go. Homer said to me, "You know, if I had said to Jim, 'Oh, you've got four young children, maybe this isn't a good place for you to be right now,' he would still be alive. But I didn't say that, and I always wonder whether I should." Monday evening, Jim arrived home early to talk to his wife, Marie. She did not want him to go. He said, "I want to go to Selma. Clergy all over the nation are going. Many Boston Unitarians are going. I want to be there too. I just can't sit home." So after frantic preparations, Marie dropped Jim Reed off at Logan Airport about 10 p.m. for an 11 p.m. flight to Atlanta. 38-year-old James Reeb had served as a Unitarian Universalist minister working as the associate minister at All Souls Unitarian Church in Washington, D.C. He was the minister of the youth group at All Souls in Washington, and one of the members of that youth group, one who still remembers Jim Reeb fondly, was a teenager named Leslie Westbrook, who I would later marry. In 1964, Reverend Reed moved from Washington to Boston to work for the American Friends Committee, but continued to be a Unitarian Universalist minister. At Logan Airport, Reed found himself greeting old friends, Unitarian Universalist ministers going from the Boston area. He joined in conversation with his colleagues. In Atlanta, the clergy napped on airport chairs, waiting for the 7 a.m. flight from Atlanta to Montgomery. So many Unitarian ministers filled the Atlanta waiting room that there was an eerie sense that they were on their way to attend an impromptu meeting at the General Assembly of the Association. After arriving in Montgomery, Southern Christian Leadership Conference cars drove them the 50 miles to Brown Chapel the African Methodist Episcopal Church in Selma. Clergy from all over the nation were pouring into Selma, and of all denominations. Meanwhile, Governor George Wallace was gathering 500 Alabama state troopers, many of them Klansmen, fully armed and battle-ready. They were under orders from the governor not to allow the march. Federal officials, from President Johnson on down, urged King to call off the Tuesday march until they could hold a federal court hearing on Thursday. With a federal court order, the president could use troops to protect the marchers. However, the court process would take several days. The reality King faced was that hundreds of persons had rushed to Selma at his request. He sent the telegram out Monday morning. He said, "We're going to march on Tuesday," and they came. They were expecting to march. So King chose a compromise. Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m., he led a march through Selma to the bridge where the attack had occurred 2 days before. To avoid another attack, King then knelt in prayer and led the marchers back to Brown Chapel in Selma. This was not a popular decision. Some marchers were frustrated. They were disappointed that they had come all that way to march. They were disappointed that King hadn't just forced his way through on to Montgomery. But others were relieved that no violence had occurred. Back at the church, King said, "At least we had to get to the point where the brutality took place 2 days ago, and we made it clear when we got there that we were going to have some form of protest and worship." King urged all who could to remain for the march, which he thought would occur on Thursday when they got the expected court order. Jim Reed had already accepted a ride back to the Montgomery Airport. He had actually put his suitcase in the back of the car. He was ready to leave Selma. However, he fell into conversation with other Unitarian Universalist ministers. They said they were going to stay until Thursday, stay over and participate in the march on Thursday. So he decided to stay also, and he retrieved his suitcase. About 6 in the evening, Jim Reeb, Reverend Orloff Miller, a Unitarian minister in the Boston area, and Reverend Clark Olson, a Unitarian Universalist minister from Berkeley, California, they met up. Clark was the son of my first minister from Phoenix, the Reverend Arthur Olson, so I knew Clark a little bit. The three went looking for dinner, having not eaten in 24 hours. They found an integrated restaurant, Walker's Cafe, and they ate fried chicken with mashed potatoes and gravy. After the meal, the other two ministers waited while Jim called his wife Marie back in Boston to say that he would be staying at least until Thursday. Olson and Miller were waiting by the door when Reeb came out. Now, if you see the movie Selma, you'll see two ministers. There were three, not two as portrayed in the movie. For a moment, they discussed whether to go left or right. Now, all of these decisions were critical. They had come from the left, but the right was a shorter route to Brown Chapel. So they went that way, falling in step together. And if you talk to Clark Olson or Orloff Miller today, they'll talk about the order in which they stood. Olson was on the inside. On the inside of the sidewalk. Jim was nearest the curb, nearest the road, and Orloff was in the middle. And they will say to you, if we had stood in a different order, it would have been us instead of Reeb who died. They had gone a step or two when they became aware that four white men on the other side of the street were coming towards them. "Hey, niggers," one of the four called. Olson saw them and started to run, but got only a few steps before they were on him. Olson turned momentarily, He looked back. He saw Orloff Miller crouching on the sidewalk with his hands over his head, protecting his head. Miller had immediately dropped to the sidewalk according to the technique that had been taught by the civil rights workers. His face was to the ground, his hands on the side of his head. One or perhaps two men were kicking him. "Now you know what it's like to be a real nigger," he heard one of them say. Olson, who by now was several steps ahead of the other two, was attacked by one of the four, who began to pound him with his fists, knocking his glasses off and breaking them. In a half a minute, 30 seconds, it was all over. Clark bent to help Orloff, whose face was cut but who was otherwise unhurt. They both turned to Jim. He lay flat on his back, conscious but dazed, and couldn't say anything. Helping him to his feet, one took his right arm and the other his left. He tried to speak, but he was incoherent, and they could make nothing out of what he said. He did, however, appear to be able to stand and even to walk with some assistance. They walked towards the office of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Reeb's talk became more coherent as they talked, as they walked, and he complained that his head ached viciously. Now, it's a long story as to how they got to the hospital. It took 4 hours to get Jim Reeb from Selma to the University Hospital in Birmingham. The surgeons immediately saw that Reeb had a massive skull fracture and a blood clot. The damage was so severe from the start, the doctors entertained virtually no hope of saving his life. Wednesday morning, President Johnson dispatched a government plane to carry Marie Reeb to Birmingham to be with her husband. At 7 p.m. on Thursday, 2 days after the attack, Marie gave permission for the doctors to remove life support, and Jim died. A little while later, Marie Reeb received a condolence call from President Johnson. He promised Air Force One, the president's plane, would return Marie with Jim's body to Boston. Saturday, the Board of Trustees of the Unitarian Universalist Association were meeting in Boston. One of our members, Jane Hopkins, was on the Unitarian Universalist staff at that time, and she was at the meeting. Jane she's too ill to be here today, but she was in attendance there when they decided to adjourn their meeting in Boston and to move the board meeting of our association down to Selma, Alabama. The trustees flew south and reopened their meeting in the rectory of the Roman Catholic Church in Selma. An estimated 250 Unitarian ministers and hundreds of Unitarian Universalist laypersons journeyed to Selma and to Montgomery. Now, Jimmy Lee Jackson's mother had not received a phone call from President Johnson. The difference between the public response to the assault on Jim Reeb, a white minister, and Jimmy Lee Jackson was apparent to the blacks in Selma. Our one Unitarian Universalist minister said to the president of our association, the Reverend Dana Greeley, "Dana never mentioned Jim Reeb without mentioning Jimmy Lee Jackson in the same breath. They are both martyrs in everyone's eyes. And only to talk about Jim is to display our own racism." Mention them both. And Dana followed this good advice. On Monday, March 15, 1965, the president addressed a joint session of the United States Congress at 9 p.m. in the evening. 70 million Americans watched on television as the president called for a voting rights bill that would guarantee the right to vote for all Americans. So a 26-year-old black man died in February. There was no movement by the president or Congress. But a white Unitarian minister from Boston died on Thursday. The joint session of Congress was the next Monday, and the president called for action. Sunday, March 21st, under protection of federal troops, a column of 3,200 people began a march from Selma to Montgomery. The marchers arrived on the next Tuesday, 2 weeks after the death of James Reeb. Speaking to 25,000 people at the Capitol, while the nation watched on live television, Martin Luther King Jr. gave one of his most notable speeches. And then, when the march was over and the deepening shadows of dusk, a pool of drivers started shuttling marchers back to Selma. One driver was a 39-year-old Unitarian Universalist woman from Detroit, Viola Liuzzo. The mother of five children, Liuzzo had gone back to college 2 years before, and she wanted to get her degree because she had been unable to get one when she was starting a family. Her contact with other students had motivated her to drive to Selma for the march. Because she had a car, she served as a person who ferried people back and forth the 50 miles from Selma to Montgomery and back. After dropping marchers off in Selma, Liuzzo headed back at night to Montgomery to pick up more marchers. In an isolated two-lane stretch of the highway, a car pulled alongside. Bullets smashed through the windows and killed Viola Liuzzo. Years later, it was determined that the person who fired the shots was an FBI informant. Not all Unitarian Universalist congregations were glad that their ministers had gone to Selma. And here we need to look at our own history. In the South, and we are in the South, several ministers lost their positions in their churches. In March of 1965, Corin Arishan was the minister of this church. He traveled to Selma with the president of this congregation to join other Unitarian Universalists. This action split this congregation. Corin Arishan wrote later that some in the congregation complained to the Unitarian Universalist district director that my going to Selma was proving to be a social embarrassment for them and the circles in Sarasota where they customarily moved. And if I was away, they said, even for such a brief mission of social justice, I was ignoring my more important pastoral responsibilities in the church. Well, 10 months after going to Selma, Corin resigned his ministry from this congregation. He left Sarasota for a position in Boston. Some in the congregation suggested to Corin that he resign and start a new Unitarian Universalist church made up of his supporters, because the congregation really was split between those who thought he was a great minister and those who thought he needed to go. Corin refused to do that because he thought it would be destructive to the health of this congregation to split it over this issue in 1965. In 1965, I was living in Phoenix, Arizona. I remember Selma. I had been raised a Unitarian Universalist. I was 14 years old, and as I watched the TV and listened to the radio, this was the first time in my life that I had ever heard the word Unitarian or Unitarian Universalist on the national news. Walter Cronkite was talking about my church, my denomination. What a breakthrough. Years later, I learned that Walter Cronkite's father had founded the Unitarian Church in Houston, but I didn't know that then. For the first time, we were on the national news, on the radio, in the newspaper. After Jim Reed died, members of the congregation in Phoenix had a canvass by phone, a very quick phone call one evening in which they raised the money to send their minister, Reverend Ray Manker, to Selma to participate in the march and to represent Arizona Unitarians. When our minister returned, when Ray returned, he preached a sermon on the experience of the march from Selma to Montgomery. I remember being there. The congregation was packed. There was not an empty seat in the room, At the end of the sermon, Ray had us all sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. He walked to the back. We were in tears at an emotional moment. He saw the ushers standing there with the collection plate, and I heard Ray say, "Oh, I forgot the collection." "Everybody sit down." And he ended the service by passing the plate. That day, that experience, it's an important part of who I am today. Congress passed the 1965 Voting Rights Act, one of the most powerful civil rights measures in American history. After the Voting Rights Act was signed into law in August of 1965, African Americans registered to vote by the hundreds of thousands. The long-term result of this law has been the election of black mayors in cities such as Birmingham and Alabama and other cities throughout the South. It changed our country. And of course, a very special election occurred in 2008. That year, Anna Reeve, Karen Reeve, Penny Luuzzo, Mary Luuzzo, and Sally Luuzzo, they get emotional. They could cast votes for the first African American president. And they could think back and remember that it was their parents who did so much to make it possible. Today, we continue this work, helping to feed the hungry in our community. So our offering for the backpack program will now be taken.